Are you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is money, happiness, and thought. And the numbers to call to get coaching on money, happiness, thought, and thriving in every area of your life are 866-254-1579, toll-free in the United States and Canada, 866-254-1579. Outside the U.S. and Canada, you can dial 001-760-918-4300. And what brought this topic to the fore for me is I was, I've been rewriting, I actually just finished rewriting the my book Super Coach, which was originally published, written 2008, published 2009. And so this is sort of like a 10th anniversary revision of the book, because when I wrote the book, I was beginning to see something about the inside-out nature of experience and about the principles behind the human experience, about what it is to wake up to who and what we really are in create and live in the world from that place. But going back and looking back on it, there were all sorts of things in there that I just thought, oh, God, did I really think that? I must have really thought that, because I could sort of remember that it used to really look that way to me. So in the course of rewriting it, there were a couple of chapters that got very extensive rewrites. And one of them was the chapter about money. And that was just made me realize, oh, gosh, money looks very different to me than it used to. And so I thought I would sort of use that as a jumping off point for our conversations today. And I'll start with a story from the book. Now, this actually is the story as was in the original, but it was called The Rich Man and the Beggar. Many years ago, a man was sitting in quiet contemplation by a riverbank when he was disturbed by a beggar from the local village. "Where is the stone?" the beggar demanded. "I must have the precious stone." The man smiled up at him. "What stone do you seek?" "I had a dream," the beggar answered, barely able to slow his words enough to speak. "And in that dream, a voice told me that if I went to the riverbank, I would find a man who would give me a precious stone that would end my poverty forever." The man looked thoughtful, then reached into his bag and pulled out a large diamond. "I wonder if this is the stone," he said kindly. "I found it on the path. If you'd like it, you may certainly have it." The beggar couldn't believe his luck, and he snatched the stone and ran back to the village before the man could change his mind. 1 year later, the beggar, now dressed in the clothes of a wealthy man, came back to the riverbank in search of his anonymous benefactor. "You've returned, my friend," said the man, who was again sitting in his favorite spot, enjoying the peaceful flow of the water before him. "What has happened?" The beggar humbled himself before the man. "Many wonderful things have happened to me because of the diamond you gave me so graciously. I have become wealthy, found a wife, and bought a home. I am now able to give employment to others and to do what I want, when I want, with whomever I want." "So why have you returned?" asked the man. "Please," the beggar said, "teach me whatever it is inside you that allowed you to give me that stone so freely." Now, the reason I love that story is it speaks to the true source of wealth, the true source of abundance, and neither of them are your bank balance. They are a sense of freedom inside you. They are a sense of absolute unconditional well-being inside you. They are a sense of the infinite creative potential of life to come through you, of the creative force to use you to create in the world. They are impersonal. There's an Arnold Patton quote that I quote in one of my other books where he said, "We don't create abundance. We create limitation. Abundance just is." And so I called the show today Money, Happiness, and Thought, because money and happiness we think of as tied in together, and actually they're two completely separate things. And we don't often see the relationship between thought and our experience of what we call money, and thought and our experience of what we call happiness. And so I thought that might be a useful thing for us to explore. So I will take your calls throughout the show. So the number is to call 866-254-1579, toll free in the United States and Canada, outside the US 001-760-918-4300. And we will begin in Canada with Bernard. Hey, Bernard, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You are welcome.
So I called because I am in a very confused, well, at least I feel like I'm in a very confused state. I don't know what to pursue as a career and to move forward in my life. I find myself to be happy. I do have happiness in my life. The other issue for me is finding my life purpose and integrating it as a career in my life. And I studied art. I pursued visual arts, and then I did my grad studies in art history. But I also, over the years, healing and being on this journey of discovering who I am, I realized that I really love holistic health or like life coaching to be one of the paths that I could take. And I don't know what step to take further because I'm kind of confused about all of it. Like, should I pursue my art business or like create a career out of it? Or should I just do holistic health and life coaching potentially in the future? So, yeah.
So let me ask you a few questions if it'd be okay. And some of them may be out there, but
sure.
That's what I do. why do you think it would be helpful to have a life's purpose?
Let me just think about that. To have a life's purpose gives me meaning, joy, and it allows me to connect with people and create better relationships and also be more creative.
And how does it do that? Because I've got a theory about it, but I want to kind of hear how it looks to you that yeah, if I knew a life's purpose, then that would be better.
Yeah. How would it do that? I think it when I on days that I feel purposeful or I felt purposeful in the past at least, I was the most creative.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of aligns me with who I am deep down, and I don't have fear, if that makes sense. Like, I don't have that much fear, or I'm not analyzing too much. I'm just in a creative space. I just do my thing, and all fear is kind of like, you know what, I hear you, I see you on the other side, but I'm still going to do this because it gives me joy. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, so let me run my theory by you. Sure. See, I think the reason that it's really helpful to know what we're up to in any given moment
mm-hmm.
is we don't have to spend a lot of thinking debating what we're up to.
Mm.
So it's like the difference between, to my mind, I've always thought the difference between what we would call a committed relationship and a casual relationship is that when things are going badly in a casual relationship, you question the relationship.
Mm.
When things are going badly in a committed relationship, you question how you're going to fix it.
Hmm. That's right.
And so in the same way, if we feel comfortable that we know what we're up to, we know why we are wherever we are, then we don't have to debate with ourselves. We don't have to fill our head up with trying to work out why we're there. And when we don't fill our heads up, we feel really good, because that's what it feels like to be alive without a lot going on in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have a life's purpose, well, boy, that would be even better than, because then I don't even have to ever question it. I don't ever have to fill my head up with that question. So I can just show up and do. Now, the only problem with it is I don't know that human beings come with a particular life purpose. I don't know that they don't. I'm not categorically saying they don't, but it's not evident to me that we do. Now, if we did, I suspect it would be something along the lines of waking up to who and what we really are. I don't think it would be anything to do with, I am here to do art. I am here to coach people. I am here to... That's just a form that sort of makes that more or less sense given the circumstances we happen to find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know if you've ever heard the story of the thief and the Zen master.
No.
Okay. So there are probably multiple versions of this story, but the one I like is that, one day a thief was robbing a house. He didn't know it was the house of a Zen master, and he'd gotten almost everything in a bag, to take away. And when the Zen master came home unexpectedly, and the thief ran, and the Zen master kind of looked around his house for a minute, grabbed something and started running after the thief. And the Zen master was a lot fitter than the thief. And of course, the thief was carrying a heavy bag of the Zen master's stuff. And the Zen master was just carrying the thing he'd grabbed out of the house. Mm-hmm. And the thief kind of finally stopped and put the bag down between him and the Zen master and kind of started backing away. And, the Zen master was waving, it looked like a shoe in his hand. And he's like, hey, look, I'm sorry. And the Zen master goes, no, sorry. You forgot the other shoe. I didn't want you to just take one shoe. I wanted to make sure you had the pair. And kind of similar to the story of the rich man and the beggar, the thief was so moved by this that he wanted to understand what the Zen master understood, and he became a student, and then he became a disciple, and then some 20 years mm-hmm. later, he became enlightened in his own right. And in his enlightenment, his sort of new followers said to him, well, what will you do now? Will you teach? And he said, no, I think I'm going to go back to being a thief. And they went, but you're enlightened. How can you go back to being a thief? And he said, well, everybody's got to do something. We have this idea that what we do has to look a certain way to be expressions of who we are. But actually, if we allow who we are to express, it will take a form. And other people may at some point go, oh, you're a dentist. Oh, you're an artist. Oh, you're a coach. But all we're really doing is being a space for the expression of this creative impulse inside us.
That makes sense. So it doesn't, from what I'm understanding, and this is just my understanding of it, is that it doesn't matter to take just one path and follow it. I could do both, and my life purpose isn't necessarily related to my career path.
Exactly. And it's not just that you could do one or both. See, you still have the simplicity of knowing what you're up to. It's just that what you're up to is following the inner knowing, following your inner unfolding.
So it could be different at different points. For example,
totally.
Right now. Okay.
And then still only having to pay attention to one thing, which is the unfolding of this wisdom inside you. But it just is going to look like different things at different times to the world.
Right. So it makes me feel like maybe I have my attention on 2-3 different things at the same time right now, and I was trying so hard to choose just one over the other because I find that my focus can be a little bit like sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
My attention, it's like I'm working on 2-3 projects right now, and I'm reading 4 or 5 different books at the same time, and I'm so confused where to put my focus on.
Yeah. Whereas the only place, to my mind, the only place you need to put your focus, and this is sort of what it means to live from the inside out, is inside, is on that inner, that sense of inclination, that sort of inner, well, what wants to happen next? What wants to happen now? What occurs to me to do now? Not worrying about, it'll wind up looking like a path later.
Right?
When you look backwards, it will look like a path. But when you look forwards, it just looks like what's next. Oh, this is next.
Right.
Okay, what's next? Oh, this is next. Okay, what's now? Oh, this is now. Can you feel how much less pressure there is?
Yes. Yeah, it feels lighter. Yeah, because I think I have a very strong analytical side at times. It comes out and it's like, I have to have a plan because, especially now, for some reason, ever since like 2-3 years ago that I've started to actually heal myself, I don't know why I've developed a perfectionist side. It's like, I have to have a plan right now, and it has to be this way, and it has to make sense in a couple of years. And so if you were
really, 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 really a fortune teller, then maybe there'd be some merit in that. But otherwise, you're basically, instead of listening to what you know to do now, you're imagining and making up what you think you'll be glad you did 3 years from now.
Right.
And it's just a completely different place to look. You're looking in your imagination, not in your knowing. You're looking in your thinking, not in your knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the whole nature of thought is it's so all over the place that if you're looking in your thinking, you're going to feel all over the place.
That's right. Do you think it's important to have a plan?
I think if it occurs to you to have a plan, you can have a plan. And if it doesn't occur to you to have a plan, you don't need a plan.
Mm.
In other words, there are times where planning might be helpful, but even in the military, which you would think would be like the ultimate, everything is planned out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the famous quote from Dwight Eisenhower when he was a general before he became president, you know, that in all matters of war, I find planning indispensable, but plans useless.
Mm.
You know, sometimes a plan is just a kind of a form of self-soothing. We do it because we feel better because we have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's fine, but that's all it is. Other times, and what we might need to be looking at in the future, but even then, you know, I think it was Mike Tyson who said, you know, everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? We in the end, however clever our plan, we got to go live our life.
That's true. Not to be rigid. It's like, yeah, plan is just good guidance, my understanding, until my calling says, well, we need to make changes right now. Or
yeah, and if you get stuck in your plan and ignore your calling,
yeah, that's right.
That would be a bummer. Thank you, Bernard.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
A pleasure. It's funny because this really is, I was saying on a call this morning to a group, I'm sure I've got a program that the tagline is a whole new way of being in the world. And then I realized listening to the credits of this show, oh, it's the radio show. That's why I hear that line all the time. But it really is a whole new way of being in the world where we are trusting that which is inside us to create whatever outside is going to be, instead of trying to create a certain outside, a certain set of circumstances, a certain way of being that we think will make us happy on the inside. And, you know, there's a story I tell in the Supercoach rewrite, but there was a version of it in the first version as well, because it's a true story. And it's of this guy I used to call the $600 million man. And the reason I called him that was because that was his net worth. And in one of our very first sessions, he said to me that he woke up every morning wondering if today was going to be the day he lost it all. And hearing that, I heard something much deeper. I realized that I had always thought there was a number that once I had that number of money, I would never worry about money. And I saw, oh my God, if $600 million isn't going to guarantee feeling financially secure, $600 billion isn't going to do it. And the little $5 million I thought that it would do, you know, would do it, wasn't going to do it. And the insight I had as I articulated it at the time is, your well-being is not dependent on your bank balance. Your sense of security is not a function of your bank balance. It's a function of knowing that our experience of life is being created entirely from thought in the moment, and that our essential nature cannot be harmed by that. Like a frying pan that can cook anything. But once you wipe it off, it's as good as new. Our nature is that. And so our security comes from the fact that we're okay no matter what experience we're having. That in us which is real is untouched by the experiences that we have. And so to try to make money in order to feel secure is to use money for something it is not designed to do. So here are the things that it seems to me that people use money for, right? So money, here's what I'm talking about when I use the word money. Money is a practical tool created to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. Right? That's all it is. It is, you know, if you think of the history of money, right? Well, the history of money was that we used to trade chickens for goats, right? And that just got unwieldy after a certain time because goats don't always like to go to where the chickens are. And it's hard to carry too many chickens. So people found ways of facilitating the exchange of goods and services. So in the oceanic cultures, they used conch shells and people shelled out for food and lodging. And then people who worked in Mesopotamia in the salt mines were paid in salt, which was called salarium. And that was where the word salary came from, the first salaried workers. And then trade got more complex and carrying shells or salt or chickens just wasn't a useful way to do it. So precious metals began to be the universal currency. And in the 19th century, they created a gold. And then they took us off the gold standard. And now all the coins and paper that we carry around, the bits of plastic that we carried around, they're not even backed by gold or chickens or anything else but faith. They're backed on our faith in our particular government's ability to continue to back our currency at a comparable level to other governments' ability to back theirs or our particular Bitcoin exchange to continue to facilitate the exchange of Bitcoin. So what's money? Is it chickens? Is it shells? Is it salt? Is it gold? Is it faith? What's money made of? Well, part of it is whatever we decide it's made of. But part of it is, it doesn't really matter. It's just a tool. And it's a practical tool created to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. And most of the things we think about money make no sense when you see it's just a practical tool created to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. And one of my favorite, there was a book called Money Freedom I read years ago, and she had this great exercise where you just substituted the word shovel for the word money and saw if it changed the way you thought about it, because a shovel is a practical tool, right, as well. And so if you think about, well, the love of shovels is the root of all evil. Yeah, that doesn't really make much sense. It takes shovels to make shovels. Well, no, not really, not necessarily. Shovels don't grow on trees. Well, that's true. But so, right? Shovels are a corrupting influence in our society. You know, what's the expression? Shovels don't dig holes, people dig holes. They're better than me because they have more shovels than I do, but they're not as good at me because I have more shovels than them. Well, that's weird, right? I'm sure you don't believe that. So then the question becomes, well, if money's just a tool, where does it go in our hierarchy of values? Like in the grand scheme of your life, how important is money and how important should money be? And the only way to answer that is by looking more philosophically as well. How do we evaluate the value of a tool? And the answer is really simple. the value of a tool is in its suitability for the job we're using it to do. So how valuable is a hammer? Well, if you're looking to pound nails into wood, it's really valuable. If you're looking to turn a screw or screw in a light bulb or get a table at a restaurant, it's not very valuable at all. How valuable is a paintbrush? Well, if you want to, we're painting my daughter Maisie's room right now. Paintbrush is really valuable in there, right? If I wanted to learn how to dance, if I wanted to go traveling to Tahiti, it's probably not that valuable to me. How valuable is money? Well, that depends entirely on what you're trying to use the money for. So that's what I said. Let's look at, well, what do we use money for? Well, a lot of people try to use money to get security, but like the $600 million man, it doesn't work, right? Trying to use money to get security is like trying to use a paperweight to hold down an 800-pound gorilla, right? It could seem like it's working if the gorilla's not moving, but as soon as the gorilla moves, you know, it's no point. And it can seem like it's working as long as I'm not thinking insecure thoughts about money, but the second my insecure thinking starts going again, there I go. It's like they say every golfer is two bad strokes away from throwing a club into the lake, right? Well, every person who thinks that their money is the source of their security is two bad business deals, two bad days in the market away from being every bit as insecure as you or I at our most insecure. Well, what else do people use money to try and buy? Well, they use money to try to buy power or freedom. But again, the problem is we don't work that way. Anytime you try to create an internal experience, whether it's power or freedom or security or anything else, through external form, like in this case, accumulating a certain amount of money, you're going to struggle. But you're not going to struggle because there's something wrong with you. You're going to struggle because it doesn't work that way. I always loved the story of Alexander the Great and Diogenes. So Diogenes, if you haven't heard of him, he was a great philosopher, Greek ascetic philosopher, and he lived in a barrel by the side of the road. Now, a barrel, I think, was quite a big thing. But, you know, so it was like an old wine barrel, so it was probably like 10 by 10. So it's not quite as weird as it sounds. But he lived in a barrel by the side of the road. And when Alexander the Great would march with his army, everybody had to bow down. And Diogenes wouldn't bow down. He was just standing in the sun watching the parade. And, you know, the soldiers came over to kill him. And Alexander stayed the soldiers' hands. And he wanted to see what this, you know, this man wanted. And, you know, who would dare stand up to him. And Diogenes, his request, he says, well, I'd really like you to step out of my sunlight so I can continue to enjoy basking in the sun. And Alexander was really impressed by this. He was not used to people not being cowed by him. And later in his life, he apparently said, truly, were I not Alexander, I would have wished to be Diogenes. And so if you think about it, well, like, why would the most powerful man in the world at the time admire this poor philosopher who lived in a barrel by the side of the road? And it was because Diogenes had just as much freedom, if not more, than Alexander. And he saw it. So can you use money to influence the actions of others? Oh, yeah, happens all the time. But it can't take away the ultimate power from each of us. What Viktor Frankl called the last of the human freedoms, which is our freedom to choose. What else do we use money for? We use money to save time. So one of the things that I found is I spent more and more time with happy millionaires, because there are happy millionaires and there are miserable millionaires, happy billionaires and miserable billionaires. But one of the things that was pretty consistent is that the happy millionaires didn't value money anywhere near as much as they valued time. So I know a lot of people, times me, who spend hours and hours to save a few $100s. And the happy millionaires will happily spend hundreds of dollars to save a few hours of time. Well, what else do we use money for? We use money to get stuff, to get experiences. And that's what money's great at. Like, that's the specific use money was actually made for, to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. So if we use money to go on a great vacation, to go on an amazing seminar, to get food and clothing and shelter. Well, that's like using a hammer to pound a nail. That's what it's worth. That's what it's for. And you get to choose which nails you pound and which experiences and stuff you use your money for. But if you're doing it to try and get a feeling, to try and get security, to try and get power, to try and get freedom, that's not what it's good for. Right? Some people use money to get money. Right? There was an old Jerry Seinfeld routine where he said, people always tell me you should have your money working for you. I have decided I'll do the work and I'm going to let the money relax. Because you send your money out there working for you, a lot of times it gets fired. You go back there. What happened? I had my money. It was here. It was working for me. Banker goes, yeah, I remember your money. You know, it was always showing up late, taking time off. We had to let it go. Now, that's a lot of investors' experience, right? It's like, I don't know about this money working for me thing, right? But one of the ways that you know you've mastered money in your life is when a certain portion of your money is working to earn more money for you while you sit back and relax at home, right? It's a legitimate use of money, right? Money can do that. Money has a value there, right? The only danger is that we get caught up in what the money's for, in why we're looking to accumulate money in the first place. And if we're trying to accumulate money because we think that will give us more security or more power or more freedom, well, you know, what's the expression? The value of your investments can go down as well as up and cannot be guaranteed. Well, that's true too, because security, power, and freedom don't come from money. But if you're accumulating money so you can purchase a more diverse set of stuff and experiences, and you love creating it, well, cool. The more the merrier. Why not? Now, the last thing that I see people use money for that money's actually pretty good for is to give people opportunities and a chance for a better life. So if you read much about charity or philanthropy, you know, you'll hear a lot about the value of giving of yourself rather than of your money. And there's no doubt, right? You give your time, you give your energy, you give your attention. It is as much a gift for you as it is for the community. But I've actually found that it's really fun putting money to use, even if you don't have very much of it. And we started doing that when the kids were little, is we'd give them money every year to give away. So the only rule was that they find a way to use it that they think is going to create a better world for other people. And so I remember one year, Oliver used his to support breast cancer research, and Clara used hers to support a children's hospital. And I think Maisie was like six, and she split her money between a charity she found that prevented cruelty to animals and one that built schools in impoverished areas. And I remember her rationale was, she was shocked there were kids who didn't have the chance to go to school. Like, that was revelatory to her. And the funny thing about giving away money for that is it's really fun. Like, if you haven't done it, you have no idea how fun it is. People talk about, oh yes, you will feel good about yourself. You will, which I always think is like, yes, you will feel superior to others. But actually, it's really cool when you start to see. And I'm talking as little as, you know, $10 to feed a hungry child. You know, one time we gave an amount of money to an organization that was, by their standards, so big they thought we were kidding. But the fun was just as much in the $10 as in the big money. Because we really kind of enjoyed this sense that we were giving somebody some opportunity that they wouldn't otherwise have, a chance for a different kind of life. And so, you know, you've probably heard the line, a portion of all I earn is mine to keep, which I think originally was taken from a book called The Richest Man in Babylon by George S. Clason. Well, I always kind of like the line, a portion of all I earn is mine to give away. And that's the fun of money, right? Is when you use money for what it's good for, you can have a lot of fun with money. So, numbers to call. Sorry, I know some of you have been holding on for a while. 866-254-1579, outside the U.S. and Canada, 001 760-918-4300. Let's go to our old friend Dan in Philadelphia. Hey, Dan, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm okay with the money situation. Currently, I'm on Social Security Disability, and I get some benefits each month to make it possible for me to live on my own in a prosperous way. So I'm calling more about psychological currency, where I'm putting my focus, where I'm being mindful. I've been working with the Creating the Impossible book.
Mm-hmm.
I've read the first sections, the first few chapters, and now I'm into the the explanation for each day for the 90 days.
Yeah.
I think I'm in the mucking about or the cutting myself infinite slack, as you talk about, because I've tried some projects. I wanted to do a gaming channel on YouTube, and I did that for about a month. And then I don't even have an appetite for that anymore. I'm designing my website, similar to the first caller who said that she had all these projects and was reading like four or five books at a time. I guess this is the natural process of the mucking about part, where I'm just sort of like trying things on for a little bit. But I just sort of, you know, since I'm following your book and your teachings, and I very much care for and appreciate what you have to share, I just wanted to take the opportunity to sort of check in and see where you see that I am from your point of view.
Well, I mean, I think it is, you know, another word for, you know, the not fancy way of saying mucking about is trying shit.
Okay.
Right. It's like you try stuff, and when you try it, you either get more engaged or less. Right. When you do it for a little while, you kind of go, yeah, wow, I want to do this even more and go deeper. Or you go, okay, that was interesting. I don't need to keep going down this road.
Okay. And I think I almost want to make the mantra of cutting myself infinite slack.
Well, the cutting yourself, I was going to say, the cutting yourself infinite slack is relevant wherever you are in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. You're you really can't do better than your best. I know we really feel like we should be able to. And we really think we know what our best should look like. But, you know, we do what we can. There are days where I startle myself with how much I get done. And there are days where I startle myself with how little I'm able to do.
Yeah.
But the overall balance is, I got a pretty productive life.
Yeah,
but if I beat myself up every time I had a duff day or week, well, I wouldn't still be in the game.
Yeah. Now, I originally Creating the Impossible, I thought of what my childhood dreams of, you know, marrying a beautiful woman, having some kids, having a house, having a car. And I'm at 41 now, and none of that is a reality. Life has sort of taken me down a different road. And I feel that with the idea of creating the impossible, the 20% chance of it happening, but that's part of life's game. I'm sort of processing as I'm talking here.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, what you mentioned about the story of Alexander and the other guy, that freedom that I have, I just have to sort of humble myself to the point of just knowing it's okay. I mean, I'm in this position in life for a reason. I may not have some of the other external things that other people do, but ultimately, could you speak to that?
Well, I think it's similar to what I was talking about with the other caller earlier, where we make up what it should look like on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel like, oh, if the outside picture matches the inside picture, I win. And if it doesn't, I lose. And because the outside picture will only ever match the inside picture for a minute, if you're trying to hold the inside picture steady, because the world is not a fixed entity,
mm-hmm.
then you're setting yourself up to feel out of whack and out of balance and incomplete most of the time.
Yeah.
But if you, as best you can, stay with the well-being inside you, with the inclination inside you, with the unfolding inside you, with the, you know, and just kind of follow that, then you get to enjoy everything.
Absolutely. I'll just leave you with one more note, which is I called a crisis line last night, and he was talking about thought, mm-hmm. as I mentioned about that. He said thought stopping and mindfulness, and I found that what similar to what you just mentioned, my mind sometimes, he says almost like time travel in thought, like going back in time or future tripping and stuff like that. I think that I'm going to try to be just mindful with what is, and I'm going to continue reading Creating the Impossible. It's wonderfully written. Thank you very much. And I wish you all the best, Michael. Thank you. So,
thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. You know, we're all, here's the thing. I've told this story on air before, but it was, in a way, the reason I like this story is because this was when I got it, when I really saw that I saw something different to what I thought. So I was doing this interview for a Swedish magazine, and they asked me what my 5-year vision for my life was. And I really thought about it because I thought, oh, that's an interesting question. And I realized, and I said to them, look, I'm really happy and I love my life. So 5 years from now, I want to be really happy and love my life. And it doesn't occur to me that trying to specify what that needs to look like does anybody any good. It will look like something. And it turns out that if we stay with this unfolding inclination in us, it's actually really cool what gets created. Like, it's stuff that we go, oh my God, that's perfect, even if we never would have thought of it. But as soon as you start going, I'll be happy when, I'll be happy if, I'll be happy when I have this much money in the bank, I'll be happy if I don't lose my money, I'll be happy when I have this kind of house or this kind of boyfriend or girlfriend or this kind of whatever, I'll be happy if I get these things, if I don't do these things. Well, now you've just made your happiness conditional. And you've made your happiness conditional on things that aren't within your control. So it would be like writing the word happiness on a piece of paper and sticking it on a bus at a bus station. Like, that's a really bad strategy because you don't know where the bus is going. You don't know when the bus is going. What if you're not on the bus? Like, what did you just do? And we do that in our thinking all day long. We attach our happiness to an amount of money. We attach our happiness to a person. We attach our happiness to how somebody thinks about us and feels about us. And we wonder why we're not happy. Well, because that's not how happiness works. Happiness, your well-being, your sense of good feeling, that's just what it feels like to be alive without too much on your mind. It's nothing to do with anything. It's just your nature. And you can be happy and use money to get stuff and experiences and use money to save time and use money to get money and use money to give opportunities and to chances for a different kind of life to people. But it's never going to make you happy. And when it feels like it's making you happy, what you're actually feeling is the absence of all the worried thinking that you used to do about money. So, how do you make money then? Because there's got to be somebody out there going, well, okay, this is all great, but how do I make money? Well, so let me give you a few things that I found helpful. So I don't know if you've ever studied economics. I never have formally studied economics, but I've spent time talking with economists and reading about economics. And it strikes me from all of my studying that the essence of economics is a simple principle. the scarcer the resource, the more people are willing to give up in order to get it. And the more easily accessible or common the resource, the less people are willing to give up in order to get it. Which is why you spend more for a ticket for Hamilton on Broadway than you do for a hot dog in New York. So, on the one hand, a plot of land in the heart of the city is going to probably be fetch more money than the same size plot in the country where there's more land. On the other hand, you know, you're probably never going to bribe the maitre d' to get into a McDonald's because it's really easy to get into a McDonald's. Well, how else does that show up? Well, you know, why is the customer always right? You probably heard that, right? The customer's always right. Why would you put up, why do businesses put up with boorish behavior, with ignorant decision-making from people who work with us, or just horrible behavior from customers? Well, because in our minds, they're the ones with money. And everyone wants money, right? So we're the common resource, and money's the scarce resource. But that's not really true. Right? We're surrounded by an abundance of money. I mean, the last estimate I saw, and this was years ago, was $44 trillion. I think it's much bigger than that now. So there's $44 trillion working around. And, you know, we say 7 billion people, but it's not really 7 billion people who are looking for the money. Right? So, you know, you've got, let's say, 1 billion people and tens of trillions of dollars. So money's not the scarce resource. You are. But as long as you see money as a scarce resource, you're going to continually inconvenience yourself in order to get it. And when you start to see yourself as the scarce resource, the money starts to inconvenience itself to get to you. So I remember having a conversation with my son about this when he was going off to college. And I told him I was teaching a course, and we did an exercise with the group where we told him to go out and make money in one of the breaks. And there were 18 participants on the course. They made $84,000 in an hour. And Oliver was like, what? In real money? Like, is that even possible? And he wanted to know how they did it. And I said to him, look, I'll tell you how to do it. But I said that wasn't even making the money wasn't the point, right? The point was bringing everybody's insecure thinking around money to the surface so that we could look at it and kind of see through it and see, oh yeah, thought takes form and thought feels a certain way. And if I have insecure thought, I feel bad and it looks like it's coming from whatever I'm thinking about, but it's not. It's just that kind of thought. And that when there isn't all that insecurity and fear, then creativity and joy and fun are natural. And Oliver was like, yeah. How do I make money? So here were the kind of three things that I outlined to him that I kind of showed him. And the first, oh, hang on. Here we go. Sorry. I'm kind of trying to follow along here. The first one was planting seeds. So you've probably heard some analogies for sales that sound like you're putting coins into a slot machine. So you make your offering, you make your pitch, you put your coins in the slot machine, and if you get lucky, sometimes the machine pays out. And if it doesn't, you either keep putting more coins into the same machine in hopes that you're going to hit the jackpot, or you move on to another machine. But if you look at sales as an opportunity to serve, then you start to see that making offers is more like planting a garden than gambling. Because it's not about mechanics, it's about living systems, it's about people. So instead of dropping coins into a machine, you're working with a living system. So instead of focusing on what you might get back if you get lucky, you got to take some time to think about what you'd like to grow. Because if you plant a tomato seed and it takes root, you'll wind up with a tomato. And if you don't like tomatoes, that might not be the best plant. So when you're planting seeds, questions like, well, who'd I love to impact? Who would I love to serve? Who would I love to contribute to? What difference would I love to make for them? What would be the most powerful, fun, useful thing I could do for this person, for this client, for this customer? if I dedicated my life to making this person's life better, to making this company's lives better, what's the biggest difference I could make for them? And if you ask yourself those kinds of questions in a spirit of genuine kind of like, I wonder what I'm going to see, then it's fun and the seeds of opportunity come back. Now, planting seeds is one of the sort of three ways that I talked to Oliver about making money. The second one was picking fruit. So in that hour where people went out and making money, some of the largest gains that people made were they went to existing customers and they created these wonderful, specially designed offers for them. And since they already had a service-based relationship with the people, they didn't have to water the soil by establishing their credibility, by proving that they could add value. They just had to find a particular difference that they'd love to make and the person would love to have made. And sometimes the fruit wasn't quite ripe yet and it was taking effort. So they'd kind of back off those. And sometimes it was a little late, like the fruit was overripe, but it kind of gone, it was a bit icky. But when the fruit was ripe, it almost falls off the tree into your hand. When there's a real fit between what you're offering and what the person wants and needs in the moment, you can do a deal on the spot. And the only way you know how ripe the fruit is you reach out, you ask questions, you share from a place of needlessness. Knowing that your well-being isn't dependent on whether they say yes or no, because your well-being is not dependent on your bank balance. Your happiness is not dependent on your bank balance. It's a function of thought in the moment, and thought's always going to change. Third thing. So we've got planting seeds and picking fruit. Well, exchanging chickens. So remember, money was originally created as a means of exchange to simplify the barter process. So instead of carrying my chickens around, I could trade for baked goods or clothing or shelter. I had money, and then I could sell my chickens for money and use the money to buy the cupcake or the sweater or the house. So what are your chickens? Like, what are the goods and services that you have to offer that will make a positive difference in the lives of others? And now, instead of exchanging them in a bartering way, you exchange them directly for cash, and then you can use the cash to get what you want. And the way that you know what your chickens are is they're things that you enjoy doing or creating, and you do and create them really well. And they're things that other people value receiving or using. So your chicken might be making cars run better, right? It might be making homes immaculately clean. It might be that you've got a gift for facilitating the exchange of goods and services, which we call sales. Or you've got a gift for facilitating the appreciation of beauty and wonder in the world, which we call art. Or you've got the ability to design a rocket ship, or you've got the ability to kick a ball in a net. And the more scarce that resource, the more money people will pay for it. And so I'm having this conversation with Oliver. I'm giving him examples of what people actually did. And he kind of came around and he went, okay, tell me the coachy bit again, right? What is it that made it fun for people instead of scary? And what I said was, when you can clearly see the difference between what money is good for, which is facilitating the exchange of goods and services, and what money is terrible for, but often used for, which is attempting to create feelings like security and peace of mind and happiness, then making money stops being about trying to make yourself feel better. And you start to realize that the better you feel, the easier it is to make money. Because the disconnect's clear. And when you begin to see that good feeling is part of your nature, it is what it feels like to be you, to be alive. And it's not something that can ever be truly impacted by how much or how little you have in the bank. Then the game of money becomes a game. And playing a game as a game makes it considerably easier to play. So I hope you enjoyed the show today. I apologize to those of you I did not get to on the calls. We will be back with another live show next week. Until then, have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.